Up and running.
Okay, so welcome to group discussion number 8 of Practical Work on Self. We're glad to have you back here with us for another discussion group. And tonight, this will be the search for Dr. Livingston. And then we'll be going on to begin with Harmless Whim. So, Dr. Livingston begins, "When we have no real identity, we can become anything suggested to us by inner and outer influences. We believe ourselves to be whatever we fall into."
So we had a lengthy discussion on this chapter last week, and it was very fruitful. But in rereading it again this week, I've seen a different slant on it that I think is going to help us. I really think it's important to for all of us to concentrate on what the first part of the header is. When we have no real identity. Almost as if we have no real identity, we have no place to calibrate from. If we don't have a strong sense of our real identity, we are swept hither and thither, as they say, by whatever influence might be out there. And so it's critical to begin defining for oneself what might be a point of real identity. It is possible to get there, but it's carving that out. And part of the technique, as we learned in the chapter, is that when you see something that is actually part of what we would call our mechanical self, you say, "I am not that." So in a certain way, what you're doing is you're retreating from untruth. You might be able to see that something is not true, and so you can mark it. And you say, "Oh, this is just my mechanical reaction." Well, you mark it at that point. And as you mark it, and you wind up developing one of the greatest tools we ever will have, and that's the tool of discernment. So in every time you see something that is, so to speak, a not me, you mark it. You mark it, and then you say, "This is not me," and "I am not this" is a phrase that's used. "I am not this," and that begins to develop that. So I don't know if there's anybody on or at all, but I think it's an important point to discuss. How do we get to a point where we have a true sense of individual identity, as opposed to this concept called we have no real identity? So is it possible to get to a place where there is real identity? That's the question posed here. And there are
Okay.
actually techniques that are given us.
David, we
So
have Sinhog, Silverdale, Ginger Rogers, Mark Roach, Mike Williamson, and Diana Hester coming in the nick of time here. And I'd like to say hello to everybody who's just joined us and assure David that he's not speaking to a vacuum.
Hi, everyone.
hello.
Hey, David.
Yeah.
Before we get started, would you mind, may I make a couple of quick comments? There are three separate and distinct comments I'd like to make.
Sure.
Okay. The first one is actually, have a request for Silverdale. Silverdale, I review the tapes of every class before we get on a new phone call, and I review them to enhance my learning. And oftentimes, I will listen to your quotations 3 and 4 times because I'm trying to absorb the material. And I know I would be very grateful if you were on the phone and spoke to us on the phone in lieu of communication via email, because I would love to understand not only what you're thinking, but what you're living. And I would like to get examples of what you discuss. That was my first issue, okay?
So are you're saying that you'd like Silverdale to be able to, what, to respond to questions?
Absolutely. The reason I am on the, I talk to you all on the phone in lieu of being on the computer is so I can talk, because learning for me is so interactive. It's so, I'm so young and so hungry for comprehension that, you know, see, you and David have become powerful teachers for me, and I'm now considering Silverdale to be a teacher as well. And I positively would love the ability to ask him questions.
Well, you have a response. He says, give me time to go to the email to get the telephone number access code, about 5 minutes, so your wish will come true.
All right. I love it. Okay. Thank you, Silverdale. So that's comment number one. Comment number two is, I've really spent a lot of time on the struggle between two sorcerers and buffers, and yeah. I want to say thank you to both of you, because, you know, Teresa, again, we've had a lot of phone calls on this very issue, and it's giving me a sense of relief that that all this quote-unquote unpleasantry inside of myself that I'm not comfortable with, I thought my spiritual path was to get rid of these pieces. I thought that they would go away. And I guess that was my naivety, and that was a buffer in itself. But now that I am where I am today in my growth, is I'm starting to understand I can integrate and assimilate my spiritual higher self, my non-phenomenal self, with my historical personality. And every so often when I actually understand that, and integrate that, I get a sense of relief.
Can I comment a little bit on that?
Absolutely. It's your phone call.
Well, we're working together.
Yeah.
We're working together. And so the idea that I, you know, this idea of believing that as I go through spiritual work, then these unpleasantries go away. I guess when I heard that this time, and I certainly could be wrong, but it appears that for me was my objection to what I call the New Age movement. It's too milquetoast. It doesn't seem to take into account life. Not a matter of getting rid of struggle. It's a matter of embracing it and strengthening our self-observation and our ability to deal with it so that we know how to go forward. So, yeah, important point. Then you're able to embrace more about who you are. You don't need to worry about hiding conflict. Conflict isn't bad. It's just that we generally don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
It causes a reaction, as you say.
No, thank you, you know, David, T, EJ, everybody. It's really, that's helping me. So that was my second comment. And my third comment, you know, hysterical, which I found to be hilarious, the last chapter of The Search for Dr. Livingston. After I sold my CPA practice, I spent 6 to 9 months struggling with my personal identity, because for 23 years I walked around saying, I am a CPA. So I spent 9 solid months in therapy, spirituality, and tears to start to say, I am more than a CPA.
I spent 9 months in therapy when I found out I was a CPA.
Yeah, that's a whole other dialogue.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this work.
Yeah, and thank EJ for making this material available to us. And, you know, you always say, well, maybe this, maybe that, but in fact, here is a book, and someone bold enough to actually take the time to write down things that are universally applicable to our everyday life. These are things that we can use every day.
Okay.
And so going back.
Excuse
Go ahead,
me. I just wanted to welcome Silverdale, formerly, to the phone part of our call. And I wanted to let you know that Pathworld and Four Paws and Sama have joined us as well on the internet.
So,
Thank you.
Dave, I'm now on the phone watching you on my computer.
Silverdale, I'm confused now. I don't know whether I should listen to you or wait till you type something in.
We'll let Diana interrogate him, and then we won't have to be concern ourselves
Hi,
with this.
Silverdale. So happy to hear your voice. I can't wait to start asking you just hundreds of questions.
Well, listen, let's not interfere with the teaching that's going on.
Okay.
Gopal's is here, too, so we've got everybody on board. It's great. So, Diana, did you have another several questions or comments that you wanted to make? Oh, forgive me. I didn't shut my caller ID off. I mean, my call waiting off.
Oh, that's, yeah.
I'm
my
good,
fault.
Too. Thank you.
You guys okay?
So, Diana, what else did you have? It seemed like you had more than one thing that you needed to say. Were you through, or was there more?
No, I covered my list. I had three, and thank you to you and David for allowing me to get through them. I've covered them.
So let's move forward with what David had, a direction he was moving in there, and then let's see in the course of our discussion if some of your questions that might be malingering from last week could be perhaps explored a little bit more.
Yeah, I'd like to make one more point on what I was saying before, if I may. And I'm now on page 82 of The Search for Dr. Livingston. And I'm in the middle of that page. The paragraph says, only when we have established an identity which is free from the sleep of the machine have we established the true source of attention. And I think it's, and then later on in the paragraph it says, it uses the term the unchanging self. So what is it that we're talking about here? What is this? And then later on 83 at the first paragraph it says, every moment we work to awaken the machine can be an opportunity to regain, uses the phrase, to regain our real identity. Isn't that interesting? He's not saying find it or discover it. It's to regain our real identity. So are these things possible? And for me, I want people to feel like in their hip pocket that this is a standard concept or standard working knowledge. What is my true identity? And if somebody, if that's that question is posed to you, do you shiver in your shoes or do you say, yes, I have a true identity? So, comments, please.
Well, for me, David, what I observe a lot in myself and also in my practice is that when people are about to go through really intensive and significant change, and we sense this, there's frequently a fear of the change, and the fear shows up as a fear of loss of identity, which is equated with nothing short of annihilation, as if change equals death. And even though we want change and we're pursuing change actively, this fear can come up and cause a great deal of dissociation. What I notice when we start to actually go through this really intensive change, I've asked quite a number of people, now that you've gone through this change, do you feel more like yourself or do you feel less like yourself? And invariably, everyone says, I feel more like myself than I did before I went through the change. So what we're calling change is actually releasing the things that we've accumulated from the outside, like other people's opinions and social conditioning and attempts to seek approval and all of these various things. What changes isn't the essence of who we are. What changes is everything that we've grafted on over the top of it. and that's not our real self. And some part of us knows that. So as frightened as we may be of change, when the change actually happens, there's almost a feeling of homecoming or relief, or why didn't I do this before?
Good.
Forepaw says, I can give a good guess if I'm not scared to be truthful. Happiness says, the ID I had at birth and before. And Sama says, I think I know I have a real identity, but don't know yet who it is. So at my current stage on this path, I feel more suitable for fertilization for flowers. Flowers are good. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Well, part of the problem also, part of the problem is that we may have an image of what the concept of true identity should look like. That it's going to look like exactly like I am, but just better. More of it. More money. Less conflict. You know, just like me, except I don't have all these problems. That's not the true identity.
Sama said, O-S-H star T.
Oh, yes.
Please, no. And
so this is truly a method of regaining our true identity, as EJ tells us, and it's a method of I'm just going to say, retreating from untruth, because there are things that we can know, that's not me. And you can say that. And it's a process.
What method are you talking about? We have a number of different methods.
Like, for instance, in that very chapter that we're discussing called The Search for Dr. Livingston, it says, if we happen to observe a temporary machine identity while it is still active, a great rare opportunity, we can remember to identify with the non-phenomenal source of attention. Remember that, Jim? By rejecting identification with the machine state, saying to ourselves, I am not this. That's the method, I mean, the method of retreating from untruth.
Okay, now Silverdale has some comments which he's typed for us. Would you like to read them to us yourself, Silverdale? Or has he disappeared?
Go ahead. I find it easier to...
You have an echo. I'll read them, and if anyone has any questions, then you can answer them if you like. An understanding of practical work on self begins with Gurdjieff's explanation regarding how and why the Absolute created the creation. When we understand how and why the Absolute did this, then we reverse engineer the process and apply it to ourselves. And Sinhug says, Silver, can you tell us exactly where chapter and verse this can be found? Mark Roach, what was it that Gurdjieff said about what was the how and why? And I'm burning to know the how and why of reverse engineering this process and applying it to ourselves. I'd love to hear you describe how that has occurred for you in your personal experience with your practice.
Silverdale, if you're going to speak on the phone, you might want to turn the volume of your computer down.
And Dave, that's what I've just done here. I'm torn between trying to explain this verbally, which I get kind of tongue-tied.
Yeah.
Or simply typing it as succinctly as possible. And
Diana?
I have more. What's
that? Let Diana speak right now. She's trying to come forward.
Go ahead, Diane.
I was actually, I was glad that the questions came forward because I was going to ask you to read the quote again because I really do struggle to understand these quotes and I can't absorb them the first time. And then, Silverdale, it's okay if you struggle to speak and if you write more succinctly. I would relate to you struggling to speak because this material is so complicated, but I would love answers to the questions that T and others have just asked of you.
I understand, Diana, that you need more detail and you need to have the brilliance of the succinct comment sort of distilled decanted out into actual life experience so that you can relate to it more directly. Is this true?
Absolutely. Thank you. Well said.
And so, Silverdale, I invite you to make like the red-faced donkey and go ahead and stammer it out.
Well, look, I've been studying Gurdjieff and E.J. Gold for 18 years, so that's what I bring to my comments. And what gradually became clear to me is that Gurdjieff wrote a trilogy called All and Everything, of course comprised of three books, in which he laid down a foundation for an understanding of how and why the absolute was forced, more or less against his will, to create the present existing creation within which we find ourselves. Once you've mastered that foundation of understanding, then everything that Gold has published, everything that EJ has published, becomes a continuation of that teaching. That is to say, it's very difficult to be able to appropriate what EJ has published without first understanding exactly how and why the absolute created the now existing creation. That's the opening statement.
Okay.
The reason the absolute created the now existing creation is because when he existed by himself alone or herself alone, this becomes important. If you use the word himself alone, then one set of reverse engineering occurs. But if you use the phrase she created the absolute herself created the absolute the creation, then you use a different set of reverse engineering to come up with the right solution. So regardless of which gender you start with, it becomes the basis for everything that follows. So.
Can you tell us what you mean by reverse engineering?
Well, look, the reason the absolute, I'm only repeating in very simple terms what Gurdjieff explains at great length. The absolute created creation because he realized that time was gradually diminishing the place of his sole residence. That is, of himself. And in the realization that time was going to eventually extinguish him, he set up the current process of reciprocal feeding and maintenance. That is, the food chain. That is, the circulatory processes of life in which one thing feeds another in order to keep the whole food chain going, so that out of half of himself, he appears within the creation, and the other half of him appears out of the creation, and then the two together feed one another. That becomes very important for understanding how to reverse engineer what the absolute did.
And in some religions, this is called the interplay between the absolute reality and Maya or illusion.
Exactly right, T. And so once you understand how... what I've just explained is why the absolute created creation within which we are struggling to figure out who we are and how we got here, all that. But then, more importantly, what Gurdjieff does is he explains how the Absolute did it. And once you understand that, then you have mastery over reverse engineering. That is to say, you can do what the Absolute, you can undo what the Absolute did, become the Absolute yourself, and then you become a co-creator within life itself. Of course, it's not something you can do in a day or a week, but it's possible to do gradually over time.
How do you experience this or flashes of this in your own personal work on yourself? And how did you get to that?
Well, first of all, to reverse engineer in order to make it entirely for me, I have spent 18 years. First of all, you have to. It's like an infant child that has been conceived. That's where I was 18 years ago, and like this was one of my comments recently. It's identical to the growth of a child. You don't expect much from that child in the first year, second year, third year. Even when that child is 10 years old, you don't expect too much. Once that child goes through puberty, other possibilities become available. But even passing through the stage of puberty doesn't make that child an adult. You need additional period of time. So in some ways, I'm an 18-year-old. But I don't have the maturity of a 30-year-old or the maturity of a 50-year-old yet. So there's a certain amount of diligent, persistent patience that's required over a fairly long period of time, unless you have somebody like me who's actually done all of this and is able to quickly, as in any schooling or educational process, bring you quickly to where you really want to be, and from there it becomes easier to leverage your own efforts.
That's a good point. That's definitely the case, and this is good encouragement for people who are starting. Mark Roach, and I'm sure most of us would like to know, what did Gurdjieff say about the how specifically or even generally? And I would still like to know what your own personal experience is of moving between your experience of the Absolute and your experience of yourself as illusion, since we're speaking about identity.
Okay, so in answer to both your question and Mark Roach's question, Gurdjieff explains it this way. In the beginning, when the Absolute existed entirely by himself alone, or existed entirely by herself alone, she, or he, maintained the place of their sole residence in accordance with two fundamental laws. One, the law of three, and each one of these three, which refers to three forces. And each of these forces is conditioned by seven aspects, or seven dimensions, or seven impulses. Each one of these three forces is conditioned by the law of seven. So when these three forces are simply the affirming force. A man is a representative of that. A denying force, a woman, is representative of that force. And then a reconciling force, which is represented by what we imagine to be the happiest, most harmonious relationship between the first two forces. This law of three, in this particular having no identity, applies in this way. This is part of reverse engineering. One of these forces perceives itself as an undifferentiated unity and it experiences that undifferentiated unity through vibratory sensations.
Yes.
And so, Teresa, in answer to your question, what have I experienced or learned? I strive to have no identity by substituting vibratory sensation as the basis for my perceptions of myself. This is one force. Diametrically opposite that, in the same way a woman is diametrically opposite of a man, or a man is diametrically opposite of a woman, while sharing some things in common, within the creation we must develop an identity in order to maintain stability of individuality in the midst of diversity.
Yes.
And so initially we develop our personality in order to establish identity in the midst of diversity. Subsequently, we learn how to develop the second force, which is undifferentiated unity based on vibratory sensations. And once we learn to do that, we've in a sense passed through a stage of puberty. We're the same that we were before, but we have more potential possibilities. And then, as Gurdjieff would go on to explain, in the development of personal being, that is the third force, one must make the sense of undifferentiated unity based on vibratory sensations the primary center of gravity, which in its flowing backward into the historical personality produces the third force, and it's the residue of that collision that produces the material for that third force, which we call immortal, imperishable being, akin to we'd say godlike characteristics, which can survive the physical death of the body with consciousness. And that's really the aim of all this evolutionary transformation. And that's what Gurdjieff points out. Now, how these three forces do that exactly, how you get these three forces to interact, requires knowledge of the law of seven, which has very specific qualities. And that's a little more complicated to explain. But once you understand that law of seven, then it becomes like learning how to play a piano. You understand that with these three fingers, you can play a chord. With this hand, you can play a chord. And with this hand, you can play a melody. And then in combining these two hands, the chord hand and the melody hand, you can play music.
And so by playing music, you're referring to what in actual daily life?
What you're referring to is experiencing what we would call the eternal moment. That is, you are present. The way it appears to you is as though you are walking through a frozen landscape. That means you have accelerated your perception of personal being to the point where everything is instantaneous intelligence. Now, naturally, this is a very high aim, but this is really the aim of all evolutionary transformation. In other words, you are a co-creator because you've reverse engineered what the Absolute did, and you have become the Absolute yourself, but only in your own local time-space continuum. That is the life that you have for yourself, wherever you happen to live or whatever time frame you perceive yourself to be living in.
Let me make a bit of a comment, Silverdale.
Sorry to dominate.
No, it's great. This is a really good background and a real great basis for a conversation. And we've been building up. I think a lot of people have been kind of longing to hear this for some period as your comments have been building up and we've sensed this wisdom in the background. Sinhog says, great discourse. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Knowledge is a funny thing, though, and I want to comment on it from another point of view, is that knowledge is like a spiral. And sometimes it's the same knowledge we hit, and we hit it at different levels of our work with it. And a lot of the comments that are being brought up at this point with the work that Silverdale is doing are actually very practical. They're pragmatic for the way he is working. But he's also telling us that this is 18 years of diligent work, and maybe certain doors have to get open from time to time in order to even see some of that material. So just positing the idea of these three concepts, the law of three, is very, very curious. But here we are in this book, Practical Work on Self. All of the data is in there, and it's come from a very, very powerful tradition. So maybe we can or cannot integrate some of this material at this moment. Definitely it can be integrated. But what we can do is, let's just say, hold in our posture some of these concepts of finding the fact of regaining our permanent self and knowing nothing. We can begin on that path, knowing nothing about the necessary philosophy behind it, which we, in order to go to the next level at some point, you do need to understand it. But at the moment, how can we proceed? And how can we proceed? And this is something that I think that EJ has given on a very, in a certain implementation genius level. He's saying, here's a simple way to begin identifying this idea of the permanent self. And it does take, Silverdale's telling us, it takes time. And I have to reread that same paragraph that's on page 83 where it says, every moment we work to awaken the machine can be an opportunity to regain our real identity. Every bit of exercise we do in this regard, we're marching down that path to another step. So we have to interpret pragmatic steps for ourselves that you can do on a day-to-day basis. It's imperative that we begin to have a feeling for what is my permanent self. And that, at a certain point, becomes desperately important to you. As soon as you start to grasp a feeling for the idea that you can get to my permanent self, then you want to protect it and cleanse it and hold it. And that takes a different effort. But it's pragmatic efforts that we can do right now. Anyway, there's a question. Go ahead. No. The question is to just expand a little bit on the concept of I am not that exercise. That would be just a matter of self-observation of your own machine and your own mechanicality. Whenever something comes up that's a mechanical response, reaction, or something, if you're fortunate enough to see it, you point to it. You point to it. And then you point to all of the ones like that until you have a sense, you begin to, as I say, retreat from that untruth. Pardon? Well, if you see something you know you're not, you don't have to define what you are, but you know that you're not that. And then you begin to possibly regain your true identity.
Okay, so Silverdale added, our permanent self is a particle of divinity which is uncreated. Then we learn to develop the law of three forces within ourself. This particle of divinity has no identity. And Mark Roach, so with respect to that question, two classic methods from Eastern religions offer ways of dealing with the practical application of the question. Silverdale, it gradually learns to experience one force as multiplicity and diversity. Then it learns to experience a second force as undifferentiated unity.
Right.
Was Mark going to say more?
Yes. The neti neti, the not this, not that method, which is similar to Ramana Maharshi's constant inquiry of who am I?
Right.
And then Silverdale says, it then combines both of these two forces to achieve the indestructible personal being.
And if I may, as we went through the human biological machine last year, what we found out is there's this interplay between, for right now I'm just going to call it the machine and the essential self, and this interplay continues almost as a battle between the two. There's a battle, and there's a battle, and the battle, and then something happens. And it's at that something happens, they begin to reconcile. They begin to, there's this incredible interplay that goes on that utilizes some of the concepts that we worked with in the human biological machine, such as adoration, where there's an adoration becomes the powerhouse, in a sense, is the engine that begins to drive that concert, that interplay between the two.
Okay, and Mark Roach, and it is asked not looking for an intellectual answer, but more a feeling sense, experiential kind of answer. And Tasama and I both like that. And he's added, the second method, the opposite of the not this, not that, neti neti method, is labeling absolutely everything as self, or the self. At that point, there's no difference between the two. Now,
right.
I'd like to see something about adoration. Adoration is, in this culture, not in the Indian culture, but in this culture, very difficult emotion for us to feel, because in some senses our initial attempts at adoration, I think sometimes we get humiliated for maybe beginning to get emotionally involved and projecting and the other kinds of things that happen when we begin to lose our sense of identity in love. Or people, even if someone adores animals, for instance, almost anything one adores, somebody who's threatened by the feeling of adoration, and a lot of people are, because adoration can take the identity apart, will make comments and kind of create a lot of awkward self-consciousness when that feeling of adoration comes up. And yet the feeling of adoration and adoration for the divine, once we can get to a place where we have maybe a purified form of adoration, where we can allow ourselves to experience adoration without being pulled into a more juvenile sense of that, when we can practice that adoration really does become a doorway. And I like, David, what you said about holding in our posture while knowing nothing. There's a way that we can hold in our posture the energetics of adoration by staying in the heart and by staying in a sense of wonder. And those feelings, when it comes to the vibrational sensations, I believe are very powerful in opening up the mysteries.
So what we're talking about and was being presented to us by the reading, by some of the individuals, are different methodologies of getting a sense of personal self. What I was struck with in rereading this Search for Dr. Livingstone is the idea that, in a certain way, it needs to become a way of life. Now, we intellectually say this idea of observing ourselves, I'm not that, I'm not that. And it's very easy to just stick with intellectual. But to carry that along as a tool, and in a sense where this form of self-observation, this applying the attention and reapplying the attention of the essential self over and over and over again, that you're just walking along with it. And even to the extent where you might stop at some point during the day, and that's what you're going to do, at 12.05 p.m. every day for 1 minute or 3 hours, that's what you're going to do. You're going to apply the attention, and you're going to just apply the attention and see what happens. And you do it, and you do it, and you do it. By definition, these are not automatic things. These are not things that just happen if you just said one right word, took one right pill, whatever. One extra seminar, uh-uh. It's the heavy lifting that gets you there. Some people are saying 18 years of focused work, and they're just beginning in a certain way. Okay.
So, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm still kind of struggling to understand all this dismantling and identification. And I understood part of what Silverdale, but I really did not understand all of it with this source of attention. So. So I kind of know what I would evolve to. If I consciously spend years working on I'm not a CPA or I'm not stupid, mean, ugly, or whatever it is, I'm assuming what I'm doing is sort of dismantling, and I'm able to pull apart these little pieces and almost put them aside, not disregard them, but realize they're no longer my primary force. So yes.
What is it that you're dismantling?
I think I'm dismantling all these falsehoods, all these mechanicalities. And this is where I'm struggling, David, if I'm not clear if I'm understanding you all. As I go through this, because I'm trying to find my real identity, the first phase right now is I'm just trying to say, okay, I'm a CPA. My belief that I was a CPA, that's a mechanicality. And by stripping that away, I'm allowing room for other mechanicalities and other falsehoods to arrive. And as I say to them, okay, you're a mechanicality, you're a falsehood, and I sort of separate them and put them on a shelf temporarily, I'm thinking, if I'm understanding you all correctly, eventually what will happen is the true identity, but I know Silverdale was kind of saying it's almost like no identity. My non-phenomenal self will surface, and at some point that gains power, and then I'm thinking the final step is almost a merger where the non-phenomenal self accepts all the mechanicalities and says, okay, you're my mechanicalities, and I love you, and I'm one with you. Am I saying this correct?
Well, in the, and in the Kabbalah, the tree of life, the absolute is at the crown, and it manifests down into way down, far, far away into the creation that is the world. And then from that point, it's struggling to come back up, struggling to come back up the paths of that tree of life to the Godhead again. And it's that interplay. Well, maybe we can't think about it on that level of cosmology, but we can sure as heck think of it in terms of our cosmology and think of it in terms of that that here I am. I got this, this thing is what I got, you know. And then Silverdale, and by the way, that's almost a direct quote out of Spinoza, too, says, we have this, in order to have an individuation, right? Thank God I have this machine here, because then I can do work. I can do work in such a way that I'm developing this infinitude of self. If I didn't have it, it'd be harder to do and develop in a certain way. But it doesn't matter in a sense why. The fact is, this is how I found myself.
David?
Now what?
Okay,
yeah.
A few people say, well said, good point. Before that, Silverdale, each of the three forces must be individually educated regarding itself. Then it must be educated regarding the nature of the other two forces. Then the three forces coexist in mutual reciprocal passivity. And I wanted to add, Diana, tell me whether this is helpful or not. There's a kind of a constant interplay. One thing first is that this interplay between essentially annihilation and self-annihilation and self-creation that we're talking about, it happens microcosmically as well as macrocosmically, which means it not only happens at the universal level and the personal level, it happens from moment to moment and from time to time, and, you know, also in a really big way, you know, kind of all or nothing. All of those different time spans are all interplaying at the same time, like holographically, where it's not just happening, you know, all or none. It's also happening in a small way from moment to moment, almost like the in-breath and the out-breath. So in Sufism, there's two ways of major practices. The men will usually do La ilaha illallah hu, which means nothing exists except God. So that's an annihilation of everything except God. And then the opposite force, which is usually the female zikr, Ishkala Mabudlela, means God is love, lover, and beloved. So that's like a divine fullness. So the feminine force, which is the emptiness, creates God as a fullness. And the masculine force, which is fullness, creates God as an emptiness. And these two forces create an interplay.
Interesting. I sort of understand that, sort of. I mean, we could spend all night talking and I wouldn't fully grasp it, and I know that. You just touched on something that was said in the last class, too, of this whole concept of lover, lover and beloved. Is it?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's appropriate to ask you all to explain that. It sounds so beautiful, and there was discussion in the last class about it, and I just didn't really understand what that meant.
What that means is it's an experience of viewing the universe from the standpoint of one of those two major forces. The multiplicity and the diversity would see the divine one way. And there's a fullness there, and so that force would want to say, La ilaha illallah hu, nothing exists except God. The undifferentiated unity would be maybe an emptiness, or it could even be the other way around, but they're different experiences. They could even flip, and then it would go into creating the image of God, the image of other, the image of the opposite force as a divine fullness. And love, lover, and beloved is a way of populating your notion of the universe into a wholeness that is undifferentiated but completely full rather than completely empty. And there's an interplay between those two things.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a few other comments we can come back to, but I don't want them to get pushed up where I can't find them. Tsama said, dismantling, disarming the ego, recognizing the puppet show of masks I wear to reveal the real essential self. Yes? Yes. Nice. Mark Roach, Ramana Maharshi, no matter what anyone said, for instance, if they asked about dealing with the different mechanicalities, no matter what was asked, he pretty much answered, who's asking the question? Who has the concern?
Right.
Find out who or what that is by constantly, experientially asking who I am over and over. Now, 1 minute to come back, Diana, to what you're asking. 1 minute you might experience yourself as fullness and you experience yourself as love. And another minute you might look to yourself and experience yourself as not being able to find anything, as emptiness and looking around for yourself and out in the edges of creation. It's a different experience. And there's an interplay between those forces. And if I'm not mistaken, what Silverdale was saying was that when the third force is more uniting and stabilizing, and through bringing the third force in, which kind of maybe the third force, I'm making this up, it's like the movement between those other parts, it's the one that mediates the duality of those, and then through that we get the indestructible personal being.
In Christian mysticism, there's the concept of the lover and the Godhead, or sometimes it's talked about the yearning of Christ for the Father. And in that yearning is created the Holy Spirit. And that's how that tradition looks at it. I wanted to make another comment to Diana, is that you might want to consider getting a copy of Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus.
Okay.
That's a book we worked with. And some of the questions you're asking are on that.
Okay.
And Mark, I wanted to affirm something that Mark was saying, which is the technique of Ramana Maharshi, who is asking, who is looking. And so as we begin to do this concept of dismantling the mechanicality of the machine, my question is, who is doing the dismantling? Who is actually looking at the mechanicality of the machine at that moment and saying, I am not that? Also, at the same time, as you reflect on that and be that, you begin to get a little bit of a sense of the permanent essential self.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And Silverdale added, the third force serves as a reconciling, harmonizing, neutralizing, and spiritualizing force. This third force brings the experience of transcendental divinity of love into the mundane ordinariness of the world. Now, Diana, this just comes up to say to you, and maybe it's silly, but one way that I began when I was first beginning to think about these things is to take the concept of human marriage between, like, if you take one person or one thing, you have a point. And if you take two things, two people, you have a line, and you have that line inherently in that is the force of opposition. You have either or, and you have potentially conflict. And then if you take a third point, then you have a triangle, then you have a mediation between those points, and there's suddenly a space inside. And I like to think about that, since you asked about love, I like to think about marriage as, well, where do you have marriage? You have marriage under God. Why do you have marriage under God, whatever that is? If you believe in God, if you don't, it's just the third force or a witness for that. Because instead of having just the opposition between the male and the female, and when I say this, we all have both elements within ourselves, but instead of having the potential conflict of the two people, what you're doing is you're agreeing to let in a third thing, which is, could be God, could be the relationship as the unity between the two of you, in addition to the two singularities. But that third force is the harmonizing force that allows a union to be possible without the two dissolving or being stuck in endless conflict. Is that useful?
Hey, can we just pause for a moment, please?
Sure. And Silverdale says you're exactly right with this illustration of marriage.
Go ahead in just a second.
Okay, we need to tape change, I think.